This is the University of Otago.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. For people who don't know, my name's Peter Joyce. I'm Dean, University of Otago, Christchurch. It's my pleasure to chair this lecture tonight by Professor David Murdoch, which is the third in a series of seven public lectures that we're putting on this year at the same time. This year, as last year, they are all inaugural professorial lectures. Although for David Murdoch, unlike many of our other speakers, there's been a considerable delay between appointment and him delivering this. And although inaugural professorial lectures are old traditions in universities, sometimes even old institutions have lapses in memory and lapses in process, and people slip through gaps, but eventually we catch up with them and they have to deliver. So David Murdoch did his medical degree through University of Otago. He then took his postgraduate training in microbiology, partly in Christchurch, partly in Liverpool. Then he ended up at Duke University in the United States. Came back to Christchurch about 2000, initially primarily employed by the DHB. And at various times since then, he has also been, as well as his university position, clinical director for the DHB microbiology department. In 2002, he was appointed, though, as professor and head of the Department of Pathology, and has done a great job over these 10 years with leading this very research-strong department within our school. So without more ado, I'll invite David to come up and deliver his belated inaugural professorial lecture on infectious diseases. David.
It might be a record, I think, maybe 10, 11 years, but thank you for the kind introduction and thank you for coming along tonight. I'm an infectious diseases doctor, and my research interest naturally is in infectious diseases, and tonight I'm going to divide my talk into two parts. Firstly, just to talk about some of the unique characteristics of infectious diseases that separate them from or distinguish them from other diseases. And then for most of it, to talk about Christchurch's contribution to research on infectious diseases. And for that one, I'm going to focus very much on respiratory infections, particularly pneumonia. And the reason for that are twofold. Firstly, there's a lot of research that's been done in Christchurch, and now I probably couldn't do justice to all the other research, but perhaps more importantly, respiratory infection research is really what Christchurch is known both nationally and internationally for. This person was the Surgeon General in the United States in the 1960s, and he apparently did a very good job, made great contributions to the public health in the United States, but he is most famous for this quote. And it says, "It is time to close the book on infectious diseases and declare the war against pestilence as won." And it's quite interesting, it's very difficult to find the original citation, and in fact, when William Stewart, before he died, was asked about it, he said, "I can't even remember saying it." But anyway, there were certainly a number of people at the time held this view, including a very prominent infectious disease physician, and it's extended to the 70s. And it really was because of the developments with a lot of new antibiotics and the effectiveness of vaccines and understanding of infectious diseases and improving living conditions. It was really thought at that time that the battle against infectious disease was going to be won and that these diseases would be much more of a problem in the future. And of course, this quote is famous because of how wrong it is. And this has been widely quoted since that time. And in fact, infectious diseases are clearly as important now as they ever have been. And this map of the world just shows some of the emerging and re-emerging infections, some infections we've known for a long time that have reappeared, or some that we didn't know about at all and have suddenly appeared. And if you'll note this is actually 10 years old. So this is from a paper 10 years ago, and in fact we can add some new antibiotic resistance in India and a new coronavirus that appeared in the Middle East causing a number of deaths and many other infections. And this is just the pattern of infectious diseases. It changes over time, but it's always there. And certainly, as I said, it's as important as it ever has been. And in terms of the burden, these are figures from the World Health Organization, over 25% of deaths overall in the world are caused by infectious diseases, and that doesn't take into account some of the chronic complications of infection, like heart disease following rheumatic fever or liver cancer following hepatitis B infection. And here is ranked some of, you can of course cut the pie in different ways, but here with this classification, consistently respiratory infections, which is our big interest, and diarrheal diseases come top of the list in terms of the burden. The big three, as we call them, in infectious disease, HIV, TB, and malaria, and these have been the target of funders, specific target to try and reduce the burden of those infections, and quite rightly. But if you add that up, it's still less than those that die of respiratory infections. And if you look further down the list, pertussis, which is whooping cough, that's a respiratory infection. Measles, people who die of measles die of pneumonia, that's a respiratory infection. So in fact, it's probably even underestimating it. And if you look at, what are some of the characteristics of infectious disease that set them apart from other human infections? There's actually quite a few, and many features that are pretty unique to infectious diseases. Firstly, the potential for unpredictable and explosive global impact. Think of influenza. And, the Spanish flu of 1918-19, of course, killed more people than during the First World War, led to widespread disturbance all around the world. And we're still, obviously, occupies a lot of time in terms of predicting when the next one will happen and how we're prepared for that. Early days, of course, the plague. Quite different now in the age of antibiotics, but there is still plague in the world in little patches. Outbreak in India in 1994 caused a lot of panic. And it's still, people think it's one of those diseases people fear. And of course, recently we've had intentional release of infections. And this was, if you recall, in 2001, the deliberate release of anthrax spores and white powder that was posted through the mail system in the US. Although only 22 people were affected, four of those died. But the widespread panic across the US in particular with stockpiling of antibiotics had a major effect. Infections are typically caused by a single agent without requirement for multiple cofactors, although there are many, many exceptions to that. So we typically have an organism. Here's the bacteria, Campylobacter, causes gastroenteritis, a particular problem around Canterbury. Influenza virus, causing influenza. And these are bacteria, the Neisseria meningitis, or meningococcus, the cause of meningococcal disease, which, of course, there was an outbreak in New Zealand through the 1990s into last decade. Infections, of course, can be transmitted. Not many diseases can be transmitted. And there are many ways you can transmit infectious diseases. These, of course, present a problem in terms of trying to control, because they can spread from person to person. But also provide opportunities for prevention, because if you can actually understand how a disease is transmitted, you can develop interventions that will stop that transmission. So malaria is transmitted by certain mosquitoes, and if you eradicate mosquitoes from an area, malaria will go away. The potential for becoming preventable is very real. And of course, vaccines have been one of the most effective and cost-effective public health interventions. Lead to a dramatic reduction in many infectious diseases. But this basic sanitation, hand washing, these have been very effective in controlling many diseases. And insecticide impregnated bed nets to prevent malaria, very effective in some parts of the world. There's also the potential for eradication, although that's really only been achieved for one infection, and that's smallpox, which was a great public health success announced in the 1980s. They stopped a war to vaccinate the last people as part of that effort, which was an amazing achievement. And in fact, that one of the polio viruses hasn't been seen for many years. We actually think that one's been eradicated. That may be the second one. But the hope is that polio will be one of the next ones to eradicate, and a few others. The pathogens that cause infections have this amazing ability to adapt and always keep ahead of the game. And this presents many problems And one of the best examples would be with antibiotic resistance. And this is a picture of a stylized picture of a bacterium. And here's some examples of how the bacterium can develop ways to become resistant to antibiotics. They can develop enzymes that break down the antibiotic. They can develop these pumps, which will then, if the antibiotics get within the cell, they'll pump them straight out, develop cell walls that will prevent the antibiotic getting inside. These are some of many examples of the way microorganisms can develop resistance to antimicrobials. And this diagram here shows through the last few decades, and above here are the new antibiotics that were introduced along the timeline. The bottom is the development of resistance to antibiotics. And it's pretty much the story with most antibiotic groups that soon after one is introduced, we'll start to see evidence of resistance developing in a number of microorganisms. I guess the other thing to note here is there's a big gap here. We're not seeing a whole lot of new antibiotics being introduced. And in fact, the drug companies are becoming quite reluctant or less enthusiastic to invest in developing new antimicrobials because it's such a difficult area. And the Infectious Disease Society of America have become particularly concerned about that, the concern that we may be returning to an era without antibiotics. Infections, of course, have a close dependence on human behaviour. So, you know, crowds, such as with pilgrimage, you know, a good environment to transmit various infections, and certainly with the Hajj, meningococcal disease has been a real problem in the past. Travellers, of course, being exposed to infections that they wouldn't otherwise be exposed to, maybe don't have immunity to. Sexual behaviour, obviously a lot of infections related to that. And the other thing is association with animals. So frequent acquisition from animals or co-evolution with animals. And so there are a number of diseases. We call them zoonoses, infections that are acquired from non-human animals. Probably the most important one in New Zealand would be leptospirosis, which farmers and freezing workers are exposed to, the most common occupationally acquired infection in New Zealand. But animals also have other roles, and I think influenza is the best example whereby pigs, for example, they're able to acquire viruses from bird influenza as well as human influenza, and they can be used as a kind of a mixing vessel of the different strains of influenza, with the risk that one that is more virulent could emerge and could affect humans. And the vets have been promoting this concept of one health. And this is the idea that we shouldn't be looking at animal health and human health in isolation. We should be looking at it together and with the environment. And this is receiving a lot of popular support by various public health institutions around the world. And it's probably a term that you'll hear more about. But in medicine, we're catching up. But the vets are very, very hot on this. So for the rest of my talk, I thought I'd just focus on the work out of Christchurch. And as I say, I'm going to focus on respiratory infections. That's what we're most well known for. And I'm going to tell a few stories of different parts of different aspects of research that's come out of here. And I'll highlight different people, the key characters along the way. And the first one is just really how things start. And from my own perspective, like so many people, my interests came about partly by chance. I started training here in Christchurch in the early 1990s, and there was a lot of work starting up at the time on pneumonia in particular, respiratory infections. So there were opportunities for young trainees to get involved in research, and there were some wonderful opportunities that happened at that time. And there's some key people I should mention, and Ian Town, of course, was a previous dean here, respiratory physician, and he was instrumental in starting some sentinel pneumonia studies in the 1990s that really led to a lot of the work that we're currently doing. Lance Jennings, who's in the back here, is New Zealand's expert on influenza and also responsible for the virology laboratory at Canterbury Health Laboratories, which has an international reputation, and that really is Lance's a lot to Lance's credit. Steve Chambers, unfortunately, couldn't be here today, and I think he wouldn't mind if I said he's the father figure for infectious diseases at the moment in New Zealand among practicing physicians. He came here in 1987 and really was He started infectious disease research in Christchurch, very much so. I know on a personal level, a mentor and a valued colleague as well. And throughout the... And the other aspect about Christchurch is a fantastic place to do clinical research. We're not too big, we're not too small. We have one catchment health system. We have a hospital, we have a fantastic laboratory. If you don't realise it, we've got a top-class laboratory in the city. And of course, we've got the university. And many of us have affiliations for more than one of these parties. And generally, people get on. And it's not just infectious diseases. This is actually a really, really good place to do clinical research that we're really envy of many places. And a lot of the initial work was on pneumonia. And those who aren't familiar, pneumonia is inflammation of the lung tissue, usually due to infections. And so here is a microscopic section of normal lung. And as you can see, there are a lot of gaps there, which is air. So these are the air spaces. These are the cells around it. This is a lung from somebody with pneumonia. And so there's been an inflammatory response. There's basically a lot of pus cells within the air spaces. And it's not hard to imagine that that's going to be difficult to move air around in there and difficult to breathe. And this is what it looks like on an X-ray. Black is air. This is the heart here. And this here, where there's no air, this is a patch of pneumonia. And pneumonia can be caused by a wide variety of different organisms. And this list is not complete, but includes many of the more common ones. And the ones I want to particularly point out, these two bacteria, Streptococcus pneumoniae, which is the most common cause of pneumonia in pretty much every age group around the world, and then Haemophilus influenzae. And I mention those because I'm going to be talking about them later. They're very effective. Vaccines have been developed for both of those agents, and they both have a significant cause around the world of pneumonia and meningitis in children and adults. Now, a lot of the work was based around some sentinel pneumonia studies. They looked at adults with community-acquired pneumonia, and this was the first one. So in 1992-1993, Alistair Neal, who was a trainee at the time, he's now an associate professor in Wellington on our campus in Wellington. And this was a study that looked at all adults admitted to Christchurch Hospital over 1 year period, intensively studied them, followed them up, did a whole raft of laboratory tests to try and find the cause of pneumonia. And there's one very similar a few years later, 1999-2000, this time led by Richard Lang, who's he was a trainee at the time, he's a respiratory physician at Christchurch Hospital now. And this one was a little different. It involved Waikato Hospital in Hamilton, a larger population and a different ethnic mix with the two combined sites. And there were many studies that were fed off these two projects, but they had a very similar study design. I'm going to run this through some of those, perhaps some of the major outputs from those studies. The first one was, there was a real interest at trying to find out, are there ways we can assess the severity of patients with pneumonia? When a doctor sees someone coming to hospital, is this somebody I need to worry about? Can I give them oral antibiotics and send them home? Do I need to go to the intensive care unit? And there were different efforts around the world to develop simple rules that a house surgeon could use or someone who's seen the patient as they came into the hospital. And this was there's one that is called the CURB score, and it basically has five variables. Here it is highlighted here. Just need to know confusion, there's a blood test, need to know the respiratory rate, the blood pressure, and how old they are. And with those five variables, you can assess the severity. They devised a system that could assess the severity of these patients with pneumonia. And in fact, this validation study here, this paper, was one where the data from Christchurch was combined with a similar study in the United Kingdom and in the Netherlands, so the three sites. And in fact, this is used all around the world. There are two systems used around the world. There's one that comes out of the United States that has 20 different variables and is very clumsy and isn't used that well, and there's this one. And this is straight out of the Blue Book, which is the book that's produced here in Christchurch for medical staff with common medical conditions, explains how the management of all these conditions. This is the page of assessing somebody with pneumonia with the CURB age score. And I think a lot of people have forgotten that. A lot of that data came from Christchurch, and this is used throughout the world and derived from those studies. There's also looked at clinician behaviour. And this was, there was an interesting finding that clinicians were reluctant, those who were reluctant to change from oral to, rather from intravenous antibiotics to oral antibiotics, kept patients in hospital longer, and they didn't do any better from that. And so there was a clear message that it was safe to send people home on earlier on oral antibiotics. We also produced the first data showing that Māori had a much higher incidence of pneumonia and pneumococcal pneumonia, which is the most common type, than other population. In fact, if you look at this graph here, which shows the age groups, so increasing age, and it's a very typical curve with the increasing incidence with age. In fact, if we studied children, it would go up. It's like a U-shaped curve, but we only looked at adults. And you can see the Māori incidence appears 2 decades earlier than non-Māori. So, well, there was also a lot of work about in the laboratory, and it really developed Canterbury Health Labs' expertise in a lot of in respiratory diagnostics. And just to give an example, there was this test. This pneumonia is a very difficult. It's very difficult to find the causes of pneumonia. Other diseases like meningitis and gastroenteritis, it's quite easy. But pneumonia, it's actually very difficult, mainly because it's difficult to get a specimen of lung. And so there's a lot of effort put into looking at alternative testing methods. And this one is a very simple one. It had a swab, you put it in the urine from a patient with pneumonia, you put it into this device, you closed it, just like a pregnancy test, and 2 lines for a positive, 1 for a negative, result in 15 minutes. And this was relatively new in the 1990s, and the study that we performed here, based with the samples from the second pneumonia study, that was the foremost study looking at this device, and the largest one to date as well. And this test, again, is now used widely throughout the world. Lance led a study looking at the viral causes of pneumonia. Typically, we think of adults that viruses are a minor cause of pneumonia. This was the first study to really extensively look at it with every available test, state-of-the-art testing methods. And with this, we were able to show that a third of these adults admitted to hospital here had evidence of a virus. And these are the viruses here. You may not know the names. Influenza, you'll know, but rhinovirus is a common respiratory virus, respiratory syncytial virus and others, and they're found in about a third of patients. So that was the first time that that had been described. And more recently, Steve Chambers and Amy Scott Thomas here are doing some very innovative work using breath, which a number of groups around the world are looking at this with the idea of that if you can capture breath from people with lung infections, you may be able to detect certain volatile organic compounds in that breath that may be signatures of certain infections. And so this is an exciting new area that they're working on at the moment. My next story. And this is one that leads directly from the early pneumonia studies in Christchurch. And this is from that first paper that came out, the first study in 1992, 1993. And these are the list of organisms that were the causes of pneumonia that were described as part of that study. So Streptococcus pneumoniae, the bacteria, is top of the list. And this is the most common cause of pneumonia, very expected result. But the unexpected result was this one. This bacteria called Legionella was very common, 11% of all the patients. And in fact, we went back with more sophisticated tests later on, and it was actually probably double that in that population. We detected it, the same number again. And Legionella, of course, is the bacterium that causes Legionnaires' disease. So this was the start of the whole interest in Legionnaires' disease that started in Christchurch. You may or may not know it, but certainly in New Zealand, Christchurch is the capital of Legionnaires' disease. In fact, it's probably in the world at the moment with our incidence of Legionnaires' disease. So this is typically a severe pneumonia caused by Legionella bacteria, of which there are several species. The one that causes most disease around the world we call Legionella pneumophila. And this is an organism that likes water. And typically, Legionnaires' disease, if you see the descriptions around the world, it's most commonly described in outbreaks. And these outbreaks are associated with a contaminated water source, like a cooling tower, or in Melbourne a few years ago, they had one with the aquarium in the middle of the city. It's unusual in the fact that there's no human-to-human transmission. You can't get it from somebody else. You can only get it from the environment. It's relatively resistant to many antibiotics that we use. So the first line antibiotics we tend to use for pneumonia, the penicillins, are not active against Legionnaires' disease. It's also difficult to diagnose because you need special tests. So for all these reasons, it's difficult to diagnose, it doesn't respond to normal antibiotics, it's acquired from the environment, and it causes severe disease. These are important and quite different from a lot of other causes of pneumonia. And of course, the first description you may have heard of, it was 1976, it was an American Legion convention. These are returned servicemen in the what was called, it changed its name after that, but it was the Bellevue Stratford Hotel in downtown Philadelphia. And this was a convention of these returned servicemen, of which over 200 were affected and 34 died. It was quite a major, major instance and was linked to the air conditioning in that building. It's now recognised that it causes a much broader spectrum of disease. It doesn't have to be severe disease. And despite people's efforts, it really cannot be distinguished clinically or by X-ray from any other cause of pneumonia. So the clinicians, when they see patients with Legionnaires' disease, based on their presenting features, just can't tell from other causes of pneumonia, and that's quite important. Now, since that time, we've done a lot of work on Legionnaires' disease. We've done a lot of work with diagnostic tests. We test more than anywhere else. We've had innovative ways that we look at it in Christchurch. And the picture is quite different. We know a lot about it. We know a lot about what happens, and there are a lot that we still don't know about it. But it is different from that typical the outbreak that was first described and what's usually described elsewhere in the world. Outbreaks are very rare, almost non-existent. But 85% of cases are due to this other species called Legionella longbeachi, which, unlike Haemophila, likes water, it's like soil. It occurs in these seasonal outbreaks in spring, summer. So I know that after Labour weekend, people will start coming in the door here at the hospital. Through November, we have this massive peak, peters out over December and through to March every year. Very, very predictable. Much more predictable than influenza. It's a very strong association with gardening. And for most of the year, well, at least rather half of the year, it is the most common cause, identified cause of pneumonia in the city, of people admitted to hospital. And it is severe. So this is local data. One third of cases end up in the intensive care and 10% die. Now, if you told that to people around the world about how common it is, they won't believe you. You know, it really is quite different from that described elsewhere. And clearly, we look harder, and that's part. We actually don't believe we're unique, and particularly around New Zealand. I'm sure there are many other places. Just if you don't look, you don't find. And we look very, very hard in Christchurch. And in fact, we've got a novel way we go about our testing. Because you cannot pick it up clinically, we talk to the clinician and say, well, look, isn't it easier if we just, rather than you ordering the tests on people you think have Legionnaires' disease, knowing that you can't pick the cases, shouldn't we just be testing everyone who has pneumonia because it's so common? And the clinicians are very supportive of that. We managed to put the business case to the labs that we should do this. We use the most sensitive test, which we call PCR, which we've done a lot of development work here in Christchurch on. And so basically, regardless of what the clinicians want to say, if there's an indication on the form that comes to the lab that the patient has pneumonia, we'll do the test. And this is what has happened. We evaluated, this is 2008, 2012, end of 2010, where the arrow is. This is when we started doing that. These are the number of cases of Legionnaires' disease over those 4 years, 2 years before, 2 years after. And basically, we quadrupled the number of cases that were identified in Christchurch. Very clear seasonal peaks. In fact, I can tell you they've continued for two more peaks after that. And clearly it was being underdiagnosed. So, I know you're waiting to know about what the story is with potting mix. And this is an interesting story. And of course, most people associate Legionnaires' disease in New Zealand with potting mix. And the story basically goes, people who have Legionnaires' disease have disproportionately report contact with potting mix. If you culture some of the potting mix, you'll find Legionella in it. But the actual link hasn't been proven absolutely yet. And in fact, we've got some information that gardening is a greater risk factor than potting mix per se. So the potting mix story may be only part of it. It probably is part of it, but but it's probably not the whole story, and there may be other factors associated with gardening. So we have now a number of studies underway. We have a case control study, a master student, Emma Carnegie, is doing that over this current season, looking at the risk factors for Legionella infection. We'll hope to get a better signal that it may be some other gardening activity. The industry have been very, very responsible, and they've come to us and said, look, there may be a problem with our product. We want to solve this, so we're working with them to do some nationwide survey of compost products. We are looking at nationwide surveillance for Legionnaires' disease because, again, we don't think it's just a Christchurch problem, and our colleagues elsewhere in the country are very interested in this. And then Tony Walls here in Christchurch is looking at Legionnaires' disease in children, which has been under virtually nothing on it in children, just adults, and so there's an ongoing project at the moment. So you'll hear more about this in the coming years. The next story. This one is a story, a few of us entered a world, a completely new world a few years ago, the world of vitamins, a rather exciting world. And this was, the vitamin we were interested in was vitamin D. And you may have heard a lot of the discussion, there's a lot of discussion currently about vitamin D and its health benefits. And if you believe, and this is, if you wade through the science and non-science, there seems to be many benefits to vitamin D, which is a hormone that has effects in multiple different parts of the body. But if you believe this, vitamin D will prevent all types of cancer, high blood pressure, osteoporosis, rickets, depression, diabetes, heart disease. And the one that we were interested in, because there was a lot made of it, was it prevented respiratory infections. And this was based on a number of low-quality studies that found that people who had certain infections seemed to have low levels of vitamin D, but whether that was linked or not, it was hard to know. The link with infection is actually quite plausible. There are many ways that vitamin D may affect the immune system in the body, making people more susceptible to infection, so deficiency may make people more, it is plausible. But everyone was saying, well, we need good quality studies. So a few years ago, we decided, well, actually, we could do that sort of study. And we thought we'd do a randomized controlled trial of vitamin D. Now, we would like to have done it in pneumonia, but we'd have had a huge number of cases, of participants to give vitamin D or placebo to see how many would or wouldn't get pneumonia. So we focused on something much more common, the common cold, which people have 2 to 3 episodes a year. And we thought, well, this is something we can do. The Health Research Council had to fund us, and I think many people in this room were actual participants in that study. And we called it the Vidara study. We looked at over 300 healthy adult New Zealanders. They were basically staff and students of this campus and the hospital board. We gave them vitamin D monthly or placebo. They didn't know which they had. We didn't know whether they had vitamin D or placebo until after the study was completed. We followed everyone up for 18 months over 2 winters. And the main things we looked at were the number of colds, how severe the colds were, number of days of work, off work due to the colds, number of times that we detected a virus during a cold episode. And this graph shows the blue are the people who had placebo, the red are the people who had the vitamin D, and this is their blood tests, which we did afterwards. And it showed you those who had the vitamin D clearly had higher levels of vitamin D in their blood, and those that had the placebo didn't. So it was always nice to see that the placebo is really placebo and the drug is really drug. The starting point here, and one thing that is important to note, is the baseline levels of vitamin D, we're expecting quite a few people to have very low levels. In fact, there weren't as many as we thought, and that may have affected our results, as I'll mention in a minute. And this slide here is a very busy table that shows the main results, but I can basically summarise it by saying there was absolutely no effect. There was no difference between those who took vitamin D and those who took placebo. Number of colds, the severity of colds, number of days off work, amazingly similar. So there was absolutely no difference. And this we concluded that the monthly dosing in this group of healthy, relatively non-deficient, vitamin D deficient adults had no effect. And this was actually what was being promoted, that everyone should have vitamin D. And that we really should focus on people who were deficient. They were the population that may benefit from vitamin D. And sometimes these negative effect studies are quite difficult to publish, but The Journal of the American Medical Association took it up, okay, and put an accompanying editorial. And, I mean, this was, blew me away. You name it, every paper in the world covered it. Every newspaper in the world covered this, covered our study. BBC had it. A colleague whose sister in Denmark sent the newspaper across with the result. It got massive exposure and was reported as relatively responsibly and accurately in all these papers. But it was interesting, the response from the zealots. Of course, there are many zealots in the vitamin world, and both those who are scientists as well as the non-scientists. And it was actually the scientists that surprised us most in terms of their disbelief in our results. And I even was asked to talk at a conference in the US, and they ended up in front of this kind of talk show. So you can find me on YouTube talking about the study. It was actually quite astounding. And I, as I'll speak in a minute, spent a lot of time focused on childhood pneumonia in the developing world, the biggest killer of kids. And you try and get the media's attention, and it's a lot more difficult than a negative study on vitamin D. And just one other, just to finish off talking about the Vidara study, this was actually our timeline. Now, any Christchurch resident will know what happened during this time. And of course, the study period, we had all of the earthquake activity. And I think one thing that was really remarkable about the study is our compliance was remained amazingly high. We hardly missed a beat. And we completed, all the deadlines were completed on time. And I think that's a real credit to one, the participants, but also to the study team. And I would just highlight study. I know Sandy's in the audience. So Sandy Slow, who was our study coordinator extraordinaire, and our team, which comprised a number of research assistants who were out there, despite personal hardship and damaged homes, and were interviewing people on the streets who were afraid to come into buildings. It was quite remarkable, so I really, really have to give credit to a remarkable team. I live in really two worlds in a way that intersect a little bit, and I've talked about a lot of the studies which have been based largely in Christchurch and principally focused on adults. But the other world I live in is focused on children and in developing countries. And for the rest of the talk, I'll be mainly focusing on this aspect. This is actually the picture of pneumonia for most of the world. It's children, it's not adults. And so here's a little boy in Kathmandu, and here's this little baby and her mother in Mali. And, you know, this is the picture for most of the world we see with pneumonia. Pneumonia is the biggest killer of young kids in the world. And these are the latest WHO figures. You can see that of the predicted 7 to 8 million childhood deaths per year, well, that was in 2010, about 18%, 1.4 million, were caused by pneumonia. And it disproportionately affects the poorest parts of the world. These are where these dots represent. This is quite an old slide, but you get the idea that this is where the concentration of childhood deaths. It's very unusual for a child to die of pneumonia in New Zealand, whereas it's very common in many places. And in actual fact, half of them occur in five countries. So India, Nigeria, DRC, Afghanistan, and Pakistan. And this doesn't hit the headlines very often, and UNICEF and WHO have really put a lot of effort in the last few years to raise awareness. And this was a document that was put out a few years ago, Pneumonia, the Forgotten Killer of Children. And it really focused on, you know, efforts to control pneumonia. And these are based around these sorts of interventions, protecting a child through encouraging breastfeeding and good nutrition, preventing them developing pneumonia through vaccination or preventing HIV infection, and those who do get unwell to have early diagnosis and treatment. And so there have been lots of efforts to try and attack it from these different ways. And I'll just pause here just to the person who really got me interested in children, into the world of children, because I'm an adult physician by background, is this guy Andy Pollard. And Andy and I have now been friends for over 20 years, and a friendship that developed through the mountains, a very interesting story. And I wrote a letter criticising an article that he had written, and it happened that we had a mutual acquaintance we didn't know who put us together after that. But we've been friends for many years. Andy's an English paediatrician. He's now the a professor at Oxford, heads the Oxford Vaccine Group, which is one of the largest vaccine research groups in the world. It's a group that's received over 30 million euros in funding over the last 5 years. It's a very, very successful group, and Andy's a very prominent figure in the vaccine world and paediatric infectious diseases. And our work has been based in Kathmandu. And Nepal is the country that I have a long association with. And started back in 2001, and we've been working in this hospital called Patan Hospital, one of three general hospitals in Kathmandu, the capital city. And the first study was actually on adults, and it was a study that started we started planning for it when I was working in the US at Duke University, and we got some funding from the US Centers for Disease Control in response to a request just to find out the causes of febrile illness, of illness with fever among adults at this hospital. And it's been an amazingly well-cited paper, one of the first to document some of the very fundamental information about infections in Kathmandu, the importance of typhoid fever, the importance of leptospirosis and typhus. But when we were there, the chief of paediatrics in the middle there, that's Neela Madhukari. She's a professor of paediatrics, a fantastic clinician, very charismatic woman. And she said to me, David, look, you know, can't ignore the children. Look, we want to know this information as well. And in particular, I want to know, you know, what is the burden of... We know the clinical presentations largely, but we just don't have the resources to do all the laboratory testing. And particularly, we want to know, what is the burden of disease that we can prevent with vaccines, and how can we persuade the government and get the resources to implement the vaccines in the country? So there are some pretty big questions. And so Andy and I have cobbled together various sorts of funding over many years, and we've put together a number of studies, all based around reinforcing the laboratory services. And this is one of the fantastic laboratory staff in this hospital, but lacking the resources to actually do a lot of the testing. So Sabina Dongle, who is one of the chief microbiologists, who's just completed a PhD at Oxford, and in fact has come over here to do some training a few years ago as well. She and others were part of a lot of projects there, and providing the infrastructure and the ability to do the extra laboratory testing. So just to give you an idea of some of the work that we've done, one of the first studies was to look at children presenting with fever, very similar to what we did with the adult study a few years before. And we looked at over 2,000 children in over nearly 2 years, a very simple study, just describing their presentation, which organisms which were causing the infections, some very, very basic stuff. And as you can see, pneumonia was very prominent. I mean, they knew that, but it was well documented in the study. Typhoid fever was very common, meningitis was common, and malnutrition was very common. We did a similar study on outpatients as well, about 1,000 outpatients. And outpatients in Kathmandu really is like a general practice. People don't have general practitioners, they just bowl up to the outpatients at the hospital. And so these were some of the presentations. We looked at summer and winter in this study. Typhoid was more common during the monsoon, we knew that. Pneumonia was common both seasons. Upper respiratory infections like colds were more common during the winter. And one of the more remarkable findings was that we took blood from all the children and tried to grow bacteria in the blood. We took blood cultures. These were outpatients. 16% had a bacteria in their blood and were managed as outpatients. Normally this is something we admit people for in Christchurch. And these were managed in the community. Most of them had typhoid fever. We did a number of studies really focused on these two bacteria I mentioned before, Streptococcus pneumoniae, Haemophilus influenzae, studies of children in the community. Were they carrying these organisms and therefore at risk of infection? What types did they have? Would they be covered by the vaccines that were around? We also did some studies with the vaccines, giving the vaccine to some children just to see that they mounted an immune response to it. All this providing background information leading to, hopefully, the implementation of the vaccine in the country. And all the time working with the Ministry of Health, which is important. And so in summary, over many studies, we're able to show that, you know, pneumonia and actually meningitis were common. that pneumococcal and Haemophilus influenzae were important causes of pneumonia, that the strains around were the type that would be covered by the vaccine, and that the vaccines were certainly efficacious in inducing an immune response. And so to our delight, and I think this in terms of applied research, seeing the research come from, seeing it go through from the fundamental, collecting fundamental information through to implementation of policy has been absolute pleasure with this work. And so this was just announced that the pneumococcal vaccine was going to be introduced in Kathmandu late this year. Actually, it's probably going to be early next year. So very, very satisfying given all the work we've done. And we've also just got some funding from the Global Alliance on Vaccines and Immunizations to do an impact study in Kathmandu as well. So that will be something we're working over the next few years, because it's important just to see the effect of the vaccine and make sure that it is suitable for the population. The next story is a slightly different one. And I was approached in 2009 by this Oren Levine, this guy in the middle, who was then at the time professor at Johns Hopkins School of Public Health, somebody that I'd worked with on a number of projects. He'd been involved in a funding body that had funded some of our projects in Nepal. And he contacted me and said, David, we've just got $40 million from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation to do a pneumonia study. It's going to be the biggest pneumonia study the world's ever seen. It's going to be under the watch of Bill Gates. We need somebody to lead the lab stuff. Are you interested? And of course I said, sure, but I'm not moving to Baltimore. And he said, fine. And so the study... And so basically the study has undergone. This is a year later. The core study group from the study in a meeting in Jerusalem. And the study is called the Perch Project. And Oren is a keen fisherman, and I think the acronym was, he had very much fish in mind, but it's called the Perch Project. And this is stands for the Pneumonia Etiology Research for Child Health. Etiology means cause, so it's a project that is really focused on finding out the causes of childhood pneumonia in developing countries. And Oren, halfway through the study, was recruited by the funders, so he's now changed and he's now the head of vaccine delivery at the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, and the principal investigator role was taken over by Kate O'Brien. And I really highlight these two people because these are two extraordinary individuals, some of the cleverest people I know. Kate's a Canadian. She now works at Johns Hopkins and is a pediatrician there. Very a major figure in the world, the vaccine world. And over this project, they've both become very close friends, and it's a real, real pleasure as part of the study to get to know a wonderful group of people, including these two. The aims of PERCH are fairly straightforward. We want to look at the cause of severe pneumonia in young children from developing countries. And the idea is that most of the information on causes is really old. It's using techniques that are obsolete, or it doesn't, on the flip side, doesn't use some more state-of-the-art diagnostic techniques. So, and in terms of funders like the Gates Foundation, it's important information to know where to direct their future efforts. You know, should they put money toward developing a vaccine against organism X? Is it common enough to do that? Is it causing that much of a problem? And so the ultimate aim is to provide information to improve policies for pneumonia prevention and treatment. The study design is a case control study. We have 7 study sites in Africa and Asia. We look at hospitalized children. Those that consent to be part of the study are intensively investigated with a number of diagnostic tests. We collect a lot of information, clinical information. We follow them for a month and check their outcome after a month. And we're using some fairly sophisticated statistical modelling to try and assess the burden of disease with all these different causes, different microorganisms. Our target was about 4,000 cases. As of 2 hours ago, I found out we'd actually stopped recruiting. So the study, after 2 years, has stopped, and we've achieved over our target. So over 4,000 children in those 7 countries. These were chosen from the catchment area of each of the hospitals. We also have controls. They're the same age, they reside in the same catchment area as the children with pneumonia, and these children have no evidence of pneumonia. That's basically the only thing we ask of them. And why do we need controls? Well, it's very important to have controls when you're looking at the, trying to assess the various diagnostic tests. It's important to know that if you're detecting something in the cases but not the controls, that is much more significant than something, than some situations where we're also detecting an organism in the case, in the controls. Also for the risk factor analysis. You can't assess risk factors unless you have a control group of people without the disease in question. Where are the sites? We had 52 applications for the to be part of the study, and we chose 7 sites that would be broadly representative of the pneumonia burden around the world. So we have 5 from Africa, Gambia, Mali, Kenya, Zambia, and South Africa, and 2 sites in Asia. Big omissions, we have no India, we have no Nigeria, which is the most populous country in Africa. And that was simply because of the quality of the applications from those sites. Bangladesh should be, the results should be very similar throughout South Asia. And in fact, Nigeria, some of the other, we've got some other regional studies, so they're probably not major deficiencies. Some have a high HIV prevalence, Zambia and South Africa. Others have a low HIV prevalence. Some are urban and some are rural. So they go from the slums of Dhaka in Bangladesh to very rural populations like here in Basay, which is in the very very east of Gambia. And one of my jobs, my main job, is to look after all the laboratory testing, which is really core to the study. And it was certainly the desire of the funders and also of the investigators that as much testing as possible gets done on site, because all of these sites already have quite a lot of experience in diagnostic testing, some more than others. And so one of my jobs was to standardise that testing across the 7 sites, and the reasons why I've had many, many sleepless nights in doing so. But it's been a big, big challenge, but a very important part of the study. And as I said, we've just completed. In fact, it went on a little longer at some sites because of where civil disturbances, etc., went on a bit longer, and we had to follow them up for a month afterwards. So we've really just completed. So I can't show you any results, obviously, at the moment, because we're going through the analysis phase this year. But just to give you a kind of, I think this is a very sobering slide. This was data from a few months ago, and it shows the case fatality rate, in other words, the proportion of children who die, and of the cases. And as you can see, and we've divided them into severe and very severe pneumonia, and there are criteria that you can distinguish those two. But as you can see, Zambia, over 20% of the children in the study died, which is awful, absolutely awful. And it was quite a difference compared to, say, Thailand. And I think just a bit of a hint, the traditional view about pneumonia is that most cases are probably caused by one pathogen, particularly bacteria, and that possibly is incorrect, and I think what we'll be concluding in the end is actually it's multiple organisms, and particularly bacteria and viruses working hand in hand causing pneumonia, with perhaps the virus setting the scene for the bacteria to cause the pneumonia, and certainly that's something that we'll be working on. I think it's a very attractive hypothesis. And needless to say, there are many, many institutions involved, but you may be interested to know that I'm not the only New Zealand connection. It's surprisingly the numbers of New Zealanders involved. So I lead the laboratory team. The principal investigator in the Gambia is an Auckland paediatrician called Steve Howie. Susan Morpeth leads the lab in Kenya. She was a former trainee here in Christchurch in infectious diseases. Nick Fancourt's an Otago graduate, paediatrician, Fulbright scholar at Johns Hopkins, who's doing a PhD on the X-ray changes in these children in the study. And John Crumpley's Professor of International Health in Dunedin's on our expert group, and Canterbury Health Laboratories is the main reference lab for the whole study. In fact, pretty much all the specimens will be arriving across the road over the next few months for specialised testing. And I've just only got one slide, but I couldn't talk about child pneumonia without actually just highlighting the fact that we have a problem in this country as well. And you would have heard the discussions about child poverty and the concerns about child poverty and increasing child poverty, and Infectious diseases follow poverty, and it is really appalling that we have any cases of rheumatic fever in New Zealand, let alone the skin and soft tissue infection rates we see, particularly in the North Island. So I think we do have to keep this on politicians in their mind, and especially in election year, because this is really important and shows the increasing inequalities in this country. I'm going to finish with my final little tale. It's not really a tale, it's just really a comment. And it's really, I've talked about a number of projects around the world, but really the strongest collaborations, most successful collaborations, have been ones which have been really built around friendships and very, very strong personal friendships with colleagues around the world, and the opportunity to get to know people and about respect for people. And this has been one of the most satisfying parts of my research career, a number of people around the world who I know and interact with are fascinating people in different environments. And the Perch Project is amazing. I mean, the people are the incredibly hard workers, exceptionally high standards, very, very demanding, but will also are also very good at trying to get a work-life balance. And so there's a lot of, when we get together, there are also a lot of social events and a lot of time out. And, you know, it is a wonderful group to interact with. And as part of this, I started something a few years ago that kind of, I never anticipated where it would go, but as some of you know, I make musical instruments, guitars and ukuleles in particular. And I started giving, a few years ago, I gave one to Andy Pollard and another friend in Iceland, colleague, and it's sort of taken off from then. And I've made quite a few instruments for various, some of the collaborators I have around the world. And you know, you need to be a good friend to be ukulele worthy, really. And so these are, they're in that, and I've produced quite a few for various people. And the Perch Project, they have a little perch inlaid in power on the 12th fret of the fretboard as a perch series. And now, in my effort to populate the world with ukuleles, I now have them in a number of places. And the trouble is, I've now started, and there are so many other people I need to do it for, and I'm way behind. But it's actually been quite a curiosity, I guess, and it's been quite a wonderful way to share friendship. And but those observers, that's not in the middle of that. That is actually in Iceland. I do have one of my ukuleles is in Iceland, with an Icelandic friend. Now, just to finish, there are too many people to acknowledge, and I hope throughout it I've mentioned, I've tried to show the names and mention a lot of the people, and I wasn't going to list them here because I was afraid I'd miss out, but I do just mention the funders, and there have been a number of funders of our work over time, and I hope I've remembered them all. But last night my wife remembered I should thank my family as well, and absolutely. So I am... And you could say needlessly you need to thank family, but it's not right. You do need to thank your family. And I have a wonderfully supportive family who are able to put up with the ups and downs of the research and my absences with the frequent travel, particularly with the Perch Project. And my final slide is a photograph I took in Mali, and in Bamako, the capital of Mali. And I often look at this photograph and this reminds me of, you know, why we're doing this, really. And think of these kids who are, you know, spend a lot of our time trying to improve their health. So thank you very much for listening.
Thank you.